You are listening to Kubernetes Bytes, a podcast bringing you the latest from the world of cloud-native data management. My name is Ryan Wallner, and I'm joined by Bhavin Shah, coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. We'll be sharing our thoughts on recent cloud-native news and talking to industry experts about their experiences and challenges managing the wealth of data in today's cloud-native ecosystem.
Introducing Wondersuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the Wondersuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are. We're coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. Today is November 9th, 2022. Hope everyone is doing well and staying safe. Let's dive into it. Bhavin, how have you been?
I've been great. We came back from KubeCon, had a lot of fun there, and the weather in Massachusetts has been awesome. Dude, 70s in early November is just next level. The weekend was awesome.
I saw that it broke a record since 1938.
Actually, okay. Nice.
Hottest November 8th or 7th, whatever day that was. Mm-hmm. Which I always kind of giggle at those because it's like, okay, who's keeping track of those?
Really? Oh, these are like the AWS stats that show up in NFL games. Like, okay, there's a 11.8% chance that this catch was made. Like, okay, who did that help? I don't know.
It's trendy though. I mean, plus I'm talking about it. Like, 1938? Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. And almost 100 years since we broke 75. Who cares? Apparently we do. So, yeah. I know we were both pretty quiet the week after KubeCon, just kind of getting back into our normal lives and, mm-hmm. and recovering a bit from travel. But what, you've done anything fun recently?
No, I think I spent this weekend. this is a stupid DIY homeowner thing.
Like, I like it. Let's go.
I think that my garbage disposal wasn't working, so I got a new one from Costco. Tried to replace it. I removed the old one. And then I realized that the new one I got came with a power plug, a power cord, and the one that I had was a direct wired mode or something like that. And then I made like a Home Depot trip, and basically that was my Sunday. I think I got it replaced. I have a small leak. I'm not sure if I need to buy a new something. I learned new words like flange. You need a backup flange or something like that. So I had a productive weekend. I wanted it to be outside because the weather was so great. But I think I spent my Sunday just going to Home Depot, coming back and working on my garbage disposal.
I like that. I it's one of the first things I did when I bought a townhouse before where I am now. But I did it differently. Mine broke because I dropped a whole bunch of glass into it and turned it on.
Oh, nice.
That's my own fault. I went back to a place called Smash It 2 in Oxford. If you've never been there, basically you rent out a room full of breakable stuff.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So you rent out a room for like 30 minutes and they give you like, we had an LCD TV, mm-hmm. probably like 40 inch. I don't know. I'm just guessing, but it was kind of big. And then we had a huge window pane. We had a whole bunch of like old compact computers, towers, mm-hmm. which those things are built like a brick. They gave us a sledgehammer and we were trying to get into those things and we could barely even like dent them, which was pretty insane. Mm-hmm. But you can get a bunch of extra buckets of glass bottles and things like that. And it's therapy.
Nice.
And if you haven't done that, I suggest it as something you probably don't know that you do need.
Okay, I need to just check that out. I need to check out how far is Oxford from where I live. So,
you're probably like an hour away because it's 30 minutes west of me. So,
gotcha.
Yeah. Cool. Anyway, all right. So we have a really cool episode on cost and Kubernetes in a little bit. We'll introduce our guest in a little, but we want to dive in a whole bunch of news that probably we didn't cover after KubeCon. So
yeah.
I'll kick it off here. There's a number of different announcements. The first one I want to lead with is the DOK, the Data on Kubernetes community that Bob and I actually participated in mm-hmm. at KubeCon. Their 2022 Data on Kubernetes report is officially out. Something that's super useful in terms of getting an idea of the appetite, as they put it, for running data on Kubernetes, and some interesting statistics and key findings that you'll find there, and some ones that I'll call out is sort of that it's a majority of individuals are actually finding they're using data on Kubernetes, and then mm-hmm. there's a lot of benefits to sort of the maturity of the product. They're having a much better experience of running data on Kubernetes, but definitely dig into that report. Data on Kubernetes community does an awesome job with this report, and it's super valuable. So go take a look. We'll have the link in the show notes on that. There's also the CNCF contributor survey is now mm-hmm. available. So we will have a link to this. It's a SurveyMonkey thing. I'm not sure how long it's open, but if you're listening to this, go click on the link. It's all about sort of your experience if you are a contributor or are aspiring to be. You don't actually have to be. So definitely useful there. And a couple news items. There's an article, a CNCF event about running multi-cloud database as a service with TIDB. And this is a key value database, and it's all about multi-cloud. I know we talk a lot about multi-cloud here, and I know we've, in our day jobs, hear it a lot. So mm-hmm. it might be a topic you're interested in. Go take a look at that. And then the other one is there is Redis. We talked about Redis, and we had Brad on the show
yep.
Live. He mentioned Redis on Flash for Kubernetes. This is actually something that we've linked to in this show, which is now the Redis on Flash is available for Redis Enterprise for Kubernetes. So if you're interested in that product and what it's all about, we will include the notes as well. Off to you and all of your news now, Bhavan.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I know this is going to be a long, long segment. Okay, so I'll quickly run through these, right? More of a rapid fire, just key highlights. So I couldn't obviously do justice to all the vendors that had announcements at KubeCon, so I just picked a few. Starting with AWS, they announced Red Hat Enterprise Linux or RHEL support for EKS Anywhere clusters. So if you're running on VMs or bare metal, you can now use RHEL in addition to Ubuntu and Bottle Rocket. If you're running EKS and you have batch workloads, and obviously we know that pods don't start and stop, now AWS EKS has an integration with AWS Batch, where Batch will queue up your workloads and spin up new worker nodes in your cluster, run those workloads, and then go away. So that's a new integration that's available. Next up, Kasten, one of the leaders in the data protection or Kubernetes data protection ecosystem. They added support for IPv6 clusters, added support for Red Hat OpenShift virtualization virtual machines. So now you can use that to protect VM-based workloads as well. And then if you are running on-prem on VMware environments, maybe using Tanzu and or running in Azure using AKS, you can now use NFS targets to store your backup snapshots as well. Next up, Aqua Security. They have a new version of Trivi. Again, we'll have more details in what the release actually includes. One key thing that I wanted to highlight is, I know Ryan and I have spoken about the NSA hardening guide. They have a flag where you can run Trivi against a cluster and you can provide a parameter that, okay, check against the NSA guide, and it will go and basically tell you what's what complies and where you need to fix things. Canonical, I think they added microkates or micro Kubernetes, and now you can deploy microkates using cluster API on any cloud platform. So if you want to experiment with it and still use cluster API, that's available. Trilio, another player in the Kubernetes data protection space, they added something called as continuous restore. So like you can have your primary cluster running applications. You can have a secondary cluster, and then Trilio will perform like a continuous restore operation on the secondary cluster. Some form of disaster recovery using a backup tool. So that was something cool. They also added support for like Red Hat OpenShift running on AWS. So ROSA service or Azure Red Hat OpenShift service or ARO service. Microsoft, they added a couple of additional things. They added Azure CNI in public preview, which is based on Cilium project. And I think while doing some research, I found out that Cilium might be headed in a direction where they might become the default CNI for EKS and AKS or GKE clusters. So a lot of things there. Talking about Red Hat, they announced a new distribution for edge deployments called Micro Shift. Again, it is derived from the OpenShift distribution, but it's edge optimized for running Kubernetes at the edge. So these can be your point of sale terminals. It can be those robots or drones that you have running, and you wanted something that matched a Kubernetes distribution on those edge devices. I think from a requirement perspective, you can deploy it as an RPM package. It has two cores and 2 gigs of RAM as that minimum requirement. So check this out if this is something that you are interested in. Next, I think I know Ryan used to work at Portworx. I still do. Portworx had a bunch of announcements, just a few to highlight. New release of Portworx Enterprise has something called PX Fast, which gives you like more than 1 million IOPS per node inside your Kubernetes cluster. So that really is useful for customers looking to run databases on your Kubernetes clusters on-prem, maybe with NVMe devices. The data protection tool from Portworx, PX Backup, now has a free tier available. So you can just create your create a free subscription, add your Kubernetes clusters, and it has all the features that Portworx Backup has. The only limitation is if you cross the 1 terabyte of stored snapshots, which will be really difficult to hit, that's the only limit, but everything else is included in that offering. There were more offerings, but announcements, but I won't cover it in this section. We'll just link to those blogs. Isovalent and Grafana Labs, they announced a strategic partnership. So now you can have eBPF-based monitoring now exposed in those Grafana dashboards. I think this was on the backs of a strategic investment that Grafana Labs made in Isovalent in their Series B funding round last month. So something that shows more and better integration between the two companies. And then I think the final one that I had on my list was Rafe Systems. And they had two new announcements or two new things in their UI. The first one being Rafe Service Mesh Manager. Sorry, that's hard to say for some reason. it is based on Istio and it provides you a good service mesh dashboard. It shows communication between different apps and allows you to enforce policies. For example, if you want MTLS to be enforced for communication between different apps, you can enforce that. And if obviously your apps are not compliant, it will block any communication. And then the final one was Network Policy Manager, another dashboard in the Rafe system, built on top of Cilium. So it is similar to how Service Mesh Manager allows you to enforce policies based on Istio. This allows you to enforce network policies. So if you wanted to block communication from a network perspective between two namespaces or anything like that, you can create those policies and enforce them using the Rafe dashboard. That was a quick list of all the news that I wanted to share today, Ryan.
Yes, that was a pretty quick job of it. So
yeah, I need to get some water now.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at the last one with Rafe, I mean, I know we saw a lot of this at KubeCon around sort of the usability and user interfaces on top of, you know, some of these more complex things. Not only things like networking and service mesh, but we saw it with application development, you know, build your app in these simple steps. So I think it's interesting to see. And so we'll see how the adoption goes with those. Anyway, moving on to today's topic, which is going to be around Kubernetes and cost. We have Jonathan Phillips and Sean Pomeroy from KubeCost, who both help companies understand their spend in Kubernetes across their different environments, whether you're in cloud or on-prem. And we're going to talk to them about KubeCost, what problems it solves, and dig into a little bit about the what, where, and when, and why. But without further ado, let's get them on the show.
Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
All right. Welcome, Sean and Jonathan, to Kubernetes Bytes. It's great to have you here. Why don't you give a little introduction for our listeners, Sean? Why don't you go first?
Yeah, sure. So hi, I'm Sean Palmer. I'm a solutions engineer here at KubeCost. So my focus is on the technical validation of KubeCost with the companies that are interested in our solution. I've been in the cloud cost space for just a bit over 8 years now.
Great. Great to have you on. Jonathan.
Great. Thank you. John Phillips and part of the go-to-market team here at KubeCost working alongside Sean. Also have been in the cloud cost management world now for about 7.5 years. Excited to get a chance to talk more.
Really exciting stuff. So I know, you know, cost has been something our listeners in the sort of community and cloud native and Kubernetes space have brought up a lot. So we're excited to have you on and kind of dig into it a bit. So I think let's start with the obvious. What is KubeCost? What problem does it solve? And sort of, you know, on a high level, how does it work?
Yeah, a really, really good question. And it's funny coming off of KubeCon because, you know, I work the booth at KubeCon and a lot of people just walk up and ask very similar question, like what is KubeCost? And I'm sure everyone here is familiar with like how crazy company names have gotten in the last few years. So one of the first questions I always ask is, well, you look at the name and you tell me what do you think we'd do? And I think our name is pretty forthcoming with what our focus is. And really, it's, right? The cost of your workloads running in Kubernetes obviously doesn't just stop right there. Really, that's just where it starts. So we're running within the cluster to determine essentially the running cost for the microservice applications that are running within Kubernetes, and then ultimately taking that information and then surfacing cost optimization opportunities.
Okay, so if I have my Kubernetes clusters today, right? Maybe 2 years back, my CIO told me, like, go ahead and implement Kubernetes. How do I actually start using KubeCost?
So Helm v3, right? Simple install, you know, depending on the size of the cluster and the complexity of the cluster, typically under a minute, maybe a few, depending on the size. We've got a fairly robust Helm chart. So a lot of configuration options, depending on the environment. We are basically like an observability tool, if you will. So we essentially collect metrics via Prometheus across the cluster. Then we also emit our own metrics. And then additionally, we're interacting with the Kubernetes API and the cloud provider APIs to get all the metadata that we need.
Got it. That's a funny that you bring that up, Bhavan, because I feel like, you know, years back, you were just told to just go innovate as fast as you can, right? And then now everybody's like, oh, wow, it's costing me a lot of money. So, you know, maybe a pinnacle of why something like KubeCost exists. But I mean, so you mentioned you gather metrics and maybe a practitioner might be thinking, okay, what does that actually mean, right? Because there's the sort of Kubernetes focus and sort of, you know, pods that are consuming CPU and memory. And then there's sort of where does Kubernetes run? You know, which part of that does KubeCost touch? Is it just sort of that orchestration level or do you go deeper into like where Kubernetes is running as well?
Yeah, so all across the board, right? So we are actually running at the container level. So we're collecting, we're using Kube State Metrics, we're using Container Advisor, we're using Node Exporter, we even have our own like network monitoring tool to collect metrics about everything happening within the cluster. And then we're also pulling in specifically the cost information from the cloud provider, right? So essentially like, what is the node cost this container is running on based on, you know, whether it's on demand or like spot preemptible, or even if you have like an enterprise discount or maybe you got some RI or savings plans that are giving you additional discounts for those resources.
Okay. So like you said, you use Prometheus to scrape some of the metrics, right? I was doing some research for the podcast, and obviously KubeCost has a really cool dashboard where you present all of this information. Can I still use my existing tools like Grafana to do some dashboarding, or do I just use the KubeCost UI to monitor my cost and allocation and budgets and stuff like that?
Yeah, we're fairly flexible in how the data can be used. Obviously, the UI is first and foremost, you know, designed for the use cases that we hear every day. But that being said, we do actually ship with Grafana. Obviously, customers can use their own Grafana instance if they already have it. But we do come bundled with a handful of dashboards that help give additional visibility into kind of why we're making the decisions we do. Like, you know, like what's the usage versus requests over the history of the runtime of that pod. But also, we've got an API, right? So if companies want to extract information and show it in something like Power BI or Looker or Tableau, we've got a lot of use cases around that where customers already have like these really well-defined like financial dashboards, and they want to pull in our insights and show it with the other companies as well.
That's super cool. Like integrating the Kubernetes deployment or Kubernetes infrastructure into existing tools that I might be using for chargeback or showback. That's a really cool feature to have. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I mean, especially in the cloud native world, right? Like we talk about like how cloud costs can get completely out of hand. I think everyone's very familiar with that topic nowadays. but more and more companies are consuming more SaaS-based offerings, right? Subscription is the way of the future. Everyone's moving to that. So a large enterprise are consuming a lot of different subscription services. So there's always an ask for like, well, yeah, I got my cloud costs here and I've got my Kubernetes costs here. Maybe I've got my Splunk, Datadog, whatever over here too. Like, let me combine them. So we're essentially a piece of that puzzle.
I know, and I think this is relevant because I think I saw an article on the Wall Street Journal yesterday how Airbnb is now looking to reduce its cloud spend, and they have laid out a roadmap of how they are just like they don't want to spend billions of dollars. Again, they have made a commitment to AWS, but they want to reduce that spend and make sure they increase profitability. So I think this is really relevant right now.
I'm sure them and many others like that.
Yeah, I was saying, and then next week they're going to release a press article saying that we're moving back to a data center, right? Because cloud is just too expensive. That seems to be the common theme and trend in this space, right? Especially for the big companies.
Absolutely. So I this kind of leads me to a question around where do you see, maybe you can talk about some real examples, a lot of this being driven from your customers. So is this, you know, the CTO or the finance team, or is this like the DevOps team saying, oh, wow, you know, we have a lot of adoption and we want to bring this in? Like, where do you sort of see this kind of entry point?
Yeah, it's actually really interesting because I've kind of seen it all. And I've been here for a year now. I'd say a lot of the time it is definitely driven from like the higher level C-level suite type situation where, you know, we need insights, we need optimizations, we need to save money. But we do see situations where like, you know, SRE, DevOps, even engineers like heard a podcast or a KubeCon or something, and they kind of like kick the tires themselves, and then that actually lends to them, you know, becoming a customer just because somebody took the initiative to like solve this problem before it was actually a problem for the company.
Okay, gotcha. So I think next question is right. Okay, if I'm an SRE, right, if I'm worried about the costs, I'm skipping or I'm exceeding my quarterly budget that was assigned to my team. How does KubeCost help me monitor my cost, right? Like, is it actual usage or is it like, let's say I'm a modern organization who has set those pod requests and limits and has some sort of intelligence. What does KubeCost monitor for? Like actual usage, requested usage, how does that work?
Yeah, that's an awesome question. And in my opinion, this is kind of one of the coolest pieces of tech that we have specific to the platform. So you summarize it really good, Bhavan. You know, with Kubernetes, you know, you have to worry about requests, you have to worry about limits. Although surprisingly, a lot of companies aren't doing that yet, but we definitely do see the more mature companies that have governance in place to like ensure that developers have to set requests and even limits when they deploy their workloads. So we actually blend the two. So because we're consuming both Kubernetes metrics and container advisor, we have access to both the usage and the requests. So we basically do a comparison, right? So let's say a workload is requesting one full core, but it's only consuming, you know, 200 millicores. We're actually going to charge or calculate the cost based on the requested capacity, right? Because that's what the scheduler is setting aside to support running that workload on a node. So in our opinion, that's also what the workload should be responsible for paying for. Now, the other side of that is, let's say that this pod is now consuming between requests and limits, right? It's consuming 1.5 cores. Now, mm-hmm. Kubecost actually switches to calculating that cost based on the actual consumption. So always the higher the two values when we're comparing usage versus requests. And that applies to CPU as well as memory. Things like storage, network load balancer, those are all calculated based on actual consumption.
Got it. Makes sense. Now, I'm going to switch gears a little bit. We actually had a listener message us with a specific question around of cost and mm-hmm. and advocacy internally. So the question was more or less like, how does one become sort of a bridge or an advocate for the engineers in working on platform to say other business and other internal business teams that they now have sort of the capability to monitor costs? Or in other words, how do we enable other teams if you're sort of controlling this feature or kubecost feature?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and in my tenure in the cloud cost space, this comes up a lot because there's kind of a few different fronts here. Number one, like a lot of companies are actually a little apprehensive to deploy a tool like this because they're worried about kind of pushback from the development teams. Like, oh, now I need to worry about cost as well as actually developing, an application that serves a purpose. But really, we've actually seen a lot of teams where they'll kind of take their own initiative and then they'll actually surface that information internally, being like, hey, look, we tested this tool. Here are some of the, the cost insights that we get based on, here's the visibility about what our applications cost to run. But additionally, the tool's also exposing how we can save money or how we can be more efficient. And then that essentially is encouraging the other teams to kind of take that same path. Mm-hmm. But really the key is making the information easily accessible, right? And easy to mm-hmm. consume. So that's kind of our focus specifically with our UI is to make it kind of easy to understand and but also provide all the information that the teams need to kind of make those informed decisions.
Got it. And now in terms of like easily accessible, is there sort of the notion of tenancy and visibility when it comes to things like internal showback? I mean, I like personally have experience being on a platform and engineering team, or they called it a DevOps engineering team back then. Right now it's platform engineering, but having lots of customers, right? Internal customers. Is there sort of a tendency to the visibility in terms of internal showback as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the majority of the time, John, feel free to hop in if you have any additional insight here. Mm-hmm. Most customers define tenancy based on namespace in the Kubernetes world, kind of the direct like mapping and how it makes sense. And that can either be an internal customer or even like we have SaaS customers, right? And they want to understand what the cost is to support their actual customers. So I'd say namespace first, followed very closely by labels. Obviously, labels raises a whole other question about like label sanitization, governance, ensuring that there's well-defined standards and that they're being applied and governed. But we kind of support all the different use cases. So one customer may define tenancy based on namespace level. Others may do it based on cluster, right? And they want to do a breakdown based on the services running within that cluster. So we don't really limit kind of what the customer can use for tenancy. We support all the Kubernetes concepts.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I'll also mention out of cluster costs that need to be associated with the in cluster workloads. That for us is achievable through labels, tagging, and really bridging the gap between not only your Kubernetes resources, but also anything out of cluster, for example, an S3 or RDS service.
Okay, gotcha. So I think, following up on Ryan's question, right? How do we become those champions inside our organizations? Again, during my research for KubeCost, I found out there's something called OpenCost, which is an open source project. There's KubeCost, which has different tiers, and there's KubeCost Free. What's the difference? How can people get started? If I don't want to pay for anything right now, but still want some analysis done so I can have a business case for my VP, how do I get started with this journey?
Yeah, so I'm going to break it down into a few different pieces. So number one, I'm glad you discovered OpenCost. We're super psyched about the OpenCost project. So it's actually kind of two pieces. First and foremost, it's a specification, right? So how do you do Kubernetes cost allocation? It's backed by, you know, all the big cloud vendors. It's also backed by Adobe and Under Armour. So a lot of really good people in the space that are helping define that spec. Secondarily, it's an implementation of the spec, right? So the OpenCost software essentially is an implementation of that specification to give people quick insights into what that looks like. All that being said, right, KubeCost is essentially the commercial version of OpenCost. We are open core, so we are consuming the OpenCost software. We also obviously employ a lot of the maintainers of that as well. KubeCost free is free forever, you know, on every unlimited number of clusters. It limits like metric retention, right? 15 days. So, I mean, for larger organizations that want to do like historical analysis, that may not be a good fit for them. But smaller teams can certainly run it forever. I think we've got over 1,000 different teams running the free version today.
Oh, wow.
And then the paid versions, you know, increase that metric retention and also add things like alerting and notifications, multi-cluster federation, right? So the free version is like KubeCost like per cluster, if you will. So you have to set up an ingress or a port forward to access our API on those clusters. Whereas like the enterprise version federates the metrics across clusters and gives you, you know, another buzzword, single pane of glass, to see the costs across all your different clusters in one spot, right? So we really love OpenCost for the contribution to the space. You know, I love the feedback from all the different members on the board, as well as contributing to the specification. And then, you know, KubeCost is basically the commercial version that builds on top of OpenCost, you know, more performant for enterprise-grade solutions.
And that's awesome, right? I think OpenCost was recently donated to CNCF as a sandbox project.
Correct.
Right?
So it's a sandbox project, yep.
Okay, so now it's inside the CNCF umbrella, people who want to contribute to the standard. I know you all already mentioned Adobe and Under Armour. So there are actual customers that are involved in building the standard and the project, maintaining the project.
Yep. Yeah, and all three cloud providers are involved. The big three are involved in the spec discussion as well.
Cool. Speaking of multiple cloud providers, right? I think there's this notion of whether you want to call it sort of a buzz term or not, the idea of adopting multiple clouds, whether that's because it comes out of necessity or you've architected it that way, you know, how does KubeCost or just that the problem statement of managing your costs across different providers, whether that's, you know, Azure and AWS, or maybe you have also some on-prem, how does KubeCost play into that full picture of multi-cloud?
Yeah, multi-cloud is an interesting discussion. Now, I personally have trouble justifying multi-cloud, and I've seen the trend go back and forth. Right, you know, I've been in the cloud space for quite some time, so I've seen and worked with customers that have adopted a multi-cloud strategy. Some from like a DR perspective, where we'll fail over to the other cloud if, you know, this cloud goes down. Others for just like availability of endpoints in regions where other clouds don't have endpoints available. From a KubeCost perspective, we are cloud agnostic. We're really platform agnostic, right? So we'll run anywhere Kubernetes runs, whether it be on cloud, on-prem, air-gapped, we don't really care. The cloud side of that equation makes it easier for us to calculate cost because the cloud providers give us cost information, right? So we pulled pricing information from on-demand pricing, but we also integrate with the billing APIs for the different cloud providers to get the actual like discounted rates a lot of these large organizations are operating under. On-prem is definitely interesting. We have kind of two different like price list models for on-prem and even cloud for like non-main hyperscalers like Alibaba or like IBM SoftLayer and such. On-prem, we'll do like basic pricing, whereas like what's the price per core? What's the price per gig of RAM? What's the price per gig of storage? What's the price per GPU? But most organizations need a bit like more granular or complex pricing. So we'll do like a custom CSV where they can actually define like the cost like per virtual machine or per bare metal node within their environment. So we can still do that cost breakdown.
A little more lift though. Okay, makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, is there kind of the I was gonna say the biggest thing with on-prem is how they want to show the costs. I mean, for companies that purchase their own hardware, they're typically following an amortization schedule, right? The assets are depreciating over time. But for like KubeCost, especially like cloud, like we want to calculate costs based on the total amortization, not like the breakdown over time, right? Because that would mean that like, well, if I have a 3-year depreciation cycle, now my resources are effectively free after year three, right? But we still want to charge back the teams for consuming those. So that's where cloud kind of makes it a little bit easier for that cost model.
Love some appreciation. Yeah.
Got it. Yeah. I think this leads me to a secondary question, right? When we're talking about multiple clouds, you know, the naughty term of egress comes up, right? Ingress, egress comes up of, you know, how does KubeCost play into that overall optimization strategy when it comes to things like network ingress and egress and those types of challenging problems that we often know very well.
I'm glad you asked that, Ryan, because in my opinion, the community doesn't talk about egress or network transfer enough. It is probably like the single thing or single line item on the bill that keeps, the profit margins in the cloud fires, because I think we can all agree that network transfer costs more than actually running the services. We don't have a ton of optimization for network today, but we do have a lot of visibility. So we actually have a daemon set we can deploy within the cluster that will track the packet source and destination. And then using the cloud provider rates, now we can actually tell you what the cost for the network transfer is down to the pod level. So you can actually understand like, well, what pod is consuming all the network capacity on this node, and then where is that going? So we can show you the destinations, whether they be like IP addresses, or we recently added actually like service tagging to the cloud providers. Okay. So you can see that like, well, hey, I've got a lot of costs for S3, but you know, I thought S3 was free, but it turns out S3 cross region is not, right? Because it's a global service, but maybe we could add like a VPC endpoint to add access to the local network and save some costs there. So stay tuned there. We are looking to add some additional insights to cost savings opportunities, specifically around network transfer in some upcoming versions.
Got it. Oh, okay.
That actually unlocks use cases, right? Like I might not be an expert in cloud and how S3 works, but using a tool like KubeCost can help me unlock and save more
exactly.
money. That's awesome.
Exactly, so, yeah.
I think my next question is around, we spoke about a lot of topics around how KubeCost shows me different kinds of information. So it's a great monitoring tool for when it comes to cost management. How can it help me reduce cost? Can you help me with enforcement as well and make changes to the settings so I don't spend as much?
Yeah, for sure. It really depends on the situation, kind of the talk track I take. A lot of our customers are not greenfield with like microservices, right? They're moving from other platforms. Maybe they're using like something like Docker Swarm Mesos earlier on, and they're moving on. So they kind of already understand what the cost is to run, but they need some help with optimization. I think where it comes in more important is for those organizations that are shifting from like a monolithic app to microservices, right? So they're brand new to the space, maybe microservices and Kubernetes in general. So like an engineer, when they're developing a microservice, they don't know what they need from resource capacity, right? They're going to run the workload, they're going to run their tests, and then figure out kind of there and maybe iterate over time and tune it as they go. In theory, that makes sense, right? In practice, it's often much different, right? We will often see, applications that are massively over-provisioned and just are just like sitting there idle, requesting the capacity, but not using it. So we like to take a bottoms-up approach with like optimizations and right-sizing specifically in Kubernetes. So we'll start like at the container and pod level. So that exact use case I just shared, we'll look at the resource running within the cluster. We'll see what the request capacity is. We'll see like what the max or peak usage is over time. And then we'll highlight like, hey, you may be under-provisioned here, right? Maybe you don't have requests set, or maybe you're consistently consuming more than you requested, or even the over-provisioned, right? So that's the real key for cost savings is, hey, why are you asking for two full cores when you're using 200 millicores for this application? So number one, we'll highlight and surface that information so that different teams can, you know, make informed decisions. But we do have the ability to take action. So we have a controller that can run within the cluster that you can essentially use the UI or the API to allow KubeCost to dynamically right-size your applications. We also have teams that are just using our APIs and essentially have built steps into their CI/CD pipelines to consume the KubeCost information, like dynamically set requests like at deployment time as well. After the right sizing, we look for like abandoned workloads. Specifically with teams just getting started in Kubernetes or even like development clusters. Often we'll see, you know, I'm sure you guys have done this as well. It's like, hey, I heard about a cool piece of software. Let me deploy it and try it out. See how it works. See what it does. And then let me get pulled into a P0 outage and completely forget that I did any of that. And then that continues running for weeks, right? So we'll look using that network transfer metrics. We'll look to see if pods are actually consuming network cycles, and if they're not, we'll highlight those and say, hey, you might want to take a look at these applications. No one seems to be actually consuming.
This is the KubeCost version of the pop up that Netflix gives you. Are you still watching?
Yes. Are you still watching? That is the perfect analogy. Hurry, yeah, where's the remote?
That's a good point. Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, your point around culture and sort of adoption of these technologies is an interesting one too, right? About sort of, we often see sort of, you know, when you're early in that sort of discovery phase, you might have the mindset of just the same that you were that had with virtual machines, right? You just provision a big old virtual machine. You have plenty of space to run your thing there. It's not going to OOM on you like the early days of exploring Docker, when many of us were just like, why is my thing OOMing, right? Maybe it's PTSD from then as well. But, you know, I think that's a good point, is that sort of culturally, it's good to think about these things up front. I mean, we've seen this with security and other, topics as well, is that they're often brought in secondarily, and then and then you're playing catch up. Like, how do I fix this, right? And it sounds like you know, maybe this is the way you think too, is that bring these cost tools in from the get go, right? Have a view of what's going on from the beginning of this process, which is in hindsight is always a little hard when we're, you know, when we're also bringing in things like Agile, move as fast as you can, right?
right. Well, see, I mean, the interesting thing there, and I love it, you're 100% correct, in my opinion, at least. The hardest part typically there is, like, it's hard to justify the cost, right, early on. Like, we understand this can be a problem in, like, 18 months, but, like, let's get ahead of it now. Let's deploy a tool that can give us the visibility. Oh, by the way, CFO, need $100,000 or whatever the piece of software costs. And that's where the free tier comes in, right? Like, because if someone's just getting started, install the free tier, install the free version, let it run, let it collect those metrics, and then as you scale and mature over time, then you can be concerned at that point about, you know, upgrading and getting, you know, additional features and functionality as your clusters grow in size.
Got it. So, and we have time for a few more questions here. One of which I wanted to sort of get your opinion on, what are the challenges going forward, right? Both with where you see the Kubernetes ecosystem going, and then what challenges does that bring on for, you know, monitoring your costs? Whether that's like, you know, we're trying to throw KubeVirt in there, run your virtual machines and your, you know, containers together, or maybe you have other ideas as well.
Yeah, I mean, in my opinion, it's scale, right? I mean, you know, today it's not unheard of to have like small to medium shops running clusters of, you know, a couple hundred nodes. I mean, we've got customers that are running, you know, upwards of 10,000, 20,000 nodes, which kind of seems insane when you think about it. But I don't think it would be crazy to have, you know, people running 100,000 nodes in the near future. So scale is definitely a big thing. Cloud provider bills are continuing to get more and more complex. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you guys have ever looked at one, but like literally it looks like a foreign language when you download the bill. there's thousands of rows. I mean, we probably have bills that are over, you know, terabyte in size for like a day of usage. And that's absolutely insane. So scale in general, I think, is going to be a huge problem. You know, not even related to KubeCost, just in general in the Kubernetes ecosystem. From our perspective, I think the complexity is kind of something that John mentioned, which is the external costs. You know, most applications running in Kubernetes, like there's dependencies outside of the cluster, right? There's going to be a database. There's going to be object storage. Maybe you've got a CDN. So that's kind of like the real helpful part from like the external cost perspective, is the ability to bring in those external costs. So like now, instead of just understanding what my application costs from a Kubernetes perspective, now I get the whole picture, which tells me like the total cost of the application, inclusive of all the other services that it's consuming. I think that's going to be huge as these applications get more and more complex and rely on cloud native technologies.
Yeah. So actually, that leads me to another question, right? I know we are talking about like how this community is evolving and different kinds of workloads are being brought on. One of the things that we saw at KubeCon this year was focus around edge deployments for Kubernetes. So like with K3S, with Microshift from Red Hat, things like that. How big is the KubeCost footprint? Like if I want to monitor it, can I monitor edge devices? Do I need KubeCost running on those edge devices? How does it work today? Or do we have a solution for it today?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the use case for those edge devices, right? I mean, the mm-hmm. typical thing we hear is, did you know that Chick-fil-A runs a Kubernetes cluster in every store? Right? Like, hey, that's great. Like, whatever works for them. But like, do they really need to understand the cost of that single cluster supporting that single store? Right? Like, they know what the cost of running that cluster is. Like, do they need to break mm-hmm. it down further? So it really depends on the use cases. Edge is really interesting, especially if it's like disconnected edge, right? Like ships running all around the world that have yeah. stuff running on. They only link up when they get to port, right? When they only have access to those metrics and that metadata. So I don't think we hear edge a ton, but we do hear it more and more, and we've definitely started to hear it more probably the latter half of this year. We don't discriminate, right? So we'll run anywhere Kubernetes is running. I have not personally tested on K3s, but I'm assuming that'll be fairly easy to get it going. Something gotcha. Else we're hearing a lot of lately is like GKE Autopilot, like, or AWS Fargate, mm-hmm. right? Those kind of like, is it Kubernetes, but it's kind of container as a service. I don't know if that plays into edge really, but we're mm-hmm. definitely seeing the continued abstraction or that shifted model of responsibility as well.
Gotcha. And like going to your website, right? We see a few great names there, Adobe, Under Armour, Tivo for some reason. Can you talk about some of these customer case studies? How did they help you build the product? How are they using it today? How much are they saving? Yeah, things like that.
Yeah, so I'm not sure which logos I can specifically talk about, but I'd say like on average, most of our customers are saving like 40-ish% when they actually go mm-hmm. down that optimization route. We've got a few case studies on our blog site, so blog.kubecost.com, specifically Green Steam, which is a shipping company. They're specifically mm-hmm. focused on sustainability around fuel waste and carbon footprint of like ships, right? Shipping containers. Yeah. So they've got some really good use cases there around capturing and visibility of the cost. So like now they can actually understand the cost to support like a specific ship from like a Kubernetes microservice container perspective. The one that I worked on specifically with the customer was Komunda. So they do they have an orchestration platform, right? So orchestrating a workflow, and they launched a SaaS offering. I think it was the tail end of last year, and they came to us because they wanted to understand what the cost was for supporting their free tier, right? So mm-hmm. a customer could sign up, say like, hey, I want to try this new tool. I get 30 days free, and from that SaaS platform perspective, they want to know like, well, hey, what does it actually cost to support a customer's free trial of our platform.
Cool use case. I imagine those conversations with what'd you say with Stream or ship something with yep. the term container. You have OG container
and an actual container. It can be a confusing conversation, that's for sure.
Nice. Well, I think these real use cases are sort of what speak to the value, right? That free tier one is a definitely, I see how that makes a lot of sense for you to want to understand something like that and really understand what's costing, you know, if we're giving away this free tier, what is it actually costing us? So
yeah,
really use cases. Where can folks get started, right? Whether that's, you know, do you have any communities they could reach out to ask questions? Do you have pages that you recommend? We'll put all the links in the show.
Yeah. All the pages, all the communities. So, I mean, KubeCost, .com, you know, our main website will give you access to all the information you need from a pricing perspective, from a documentation perspective, as well as communities. We have an open cost channel in the CNCF Slack workspace for those that want to contribute and get involved in the open cost project, whether it be from the software perspective or the spec side. We have our own dedicated KubeCost Slack community. So same links on that KubeCost website. We are launching a new docs platform in a few weeks. So we'll see some changes there that will allow some additional contributions. And we also have some additional open source projects that are kind of outside of open cost. So we have a kubectl cost plugin. So essentially engineers and developers can get like their KubeCost metrics at the command line, you know, for those that are living and breathing at the command line. We also have like a cluster controller for like resizing and automating workloads that is open source as well.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Awesome. Before we end our discussion here, since we didn't get to sync up at KubeCon, I'd love to get sort of your thoughts on this past, KubeCon in Detroit, both, Jonathan and yourself, what you thought of it and, any takeaways you might have.
Yeah, so I actually have not spent much time in Detroit. I went to the North American Car Show a few years back. That's probably the longest stint I spent in Detroit. So it was cool to stay downtown and walk around and check things out. Obviously had some pizza. That was nice. I've never had Detroit pizza either. So definitely thumbs up there. Looking forward to the Chicago one to see how it compares. Buddies.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, got some buddies.
80% buddies here.
yeah. No, it was good. I'm not a huge fan of Chicago pie, but I'm willing to give it a try next year in Chicago when KubeCon moves there. The show floor was awesome. I think we had some pretty consistent traffic. I mentioned the Microsoft booth with the Forza simulation racing. I hit that a few times. That was fun. It was 1 second off the lead. I was hoping to win, an Xbox, but couldn't make it happen. But yeah, the show was great. I heard a lot of good feedback on sessions. We didn't have any sessions this KubeCon, but we're going to have some for reInvent for anyone that's going. But yeah, good time all around. Good people, good food, really good conversations. Had a good time.
Yeah, I would totally second that. My first time in Detroit as well, but not my first time at KubeCon. And this one, I would say, definitely a lot more of the enterprise customers that made their way to Detroit for the show, as well as a lot around automation, CI/CD, just seeing the progression of Kubernetes and cloud native in general, it's just become so much more advanced. So really interested to see a lot of these new companies that have come out supporting Terraform and really helping with a lot of this automation built into CI/CD pipelines. And there's a lot coming from us in that sense with some of our larger enterprise customers, especially in the gaming community, who are utilizing all of our APIs to feed into these homegrown systems. So excited to see kind of the next iteration of that. But overall, just really great show. Great to see everyone. Next time we definitely need to link up. I know you guys were all super busy, but great to see the community expand and be where it's at today.
Yeah, it was really nice to see everyone's face IRL, as they say. So cool. Well, I really enjoyed this discussion. I think there's a lot of super valuable information in this, and it was great to have you both on the show, and hopefully we'll do it again in the future.
Yeah, I mean, the pleasure is all ours. Thank you so much for inviting us on.
Yeah, thank you. This has been great.
Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
All right, Bhavan, that was a really good conversation. I know I mentioned this during the show. It's definitely an aspect of Kubernetes, which I'm still learning a lot of, and definitely one of my novice sort of topics. Mm-hmm. So I found that really interesting. Let's dive into our takeaways, right? I think for me, the sort of actual usage versus real usage discussion is something I think we've seen over the years, especially when it relates to sort of that DevOps culture shift. Mm-hmm. I mean, it happens without the DevOps culture shift, but in most scenarios, the sort of agile development, the switch to DevOps, and changing that mindset of, you know, consuming and deploying VMs versus containers is a challenge. I know this is something that often goes overlooked when deploying containers, at least early in that journey, meaning that you'll just over-provision so that your application doesn't run out of memory or doesn't run out of CPU, something that folks are used to doing with virtual machines, I think, and kind of getting away with it because it's more acceptable, maybe. But that real usage and actual usage, it's also something that's not necessarily ideally clear and understandable, meaning that if you deploy with quotas, you're probably going to wind up, you know, OOMing your application at some point because nothing's really doing anything to monitor the real-time usage of those things, unless you have those things set up. And and there's just a lot of moving pieces. So I think it's a really good insight. And to their point, is there one of the first places to look, right? And then the other thing was the challenges around sort of that full optimization story, right? So not just what the containers are consuming and how to schedule them and pack them correctly on the nodes, but really what's external to Kubernetes, right? What are you consuming when it comes to like snapshots or S3 or egress? I know you had some points you wanted to make on egress.
I know egress was interesting, right? Like I like how they have handled that scenario where they said they actually run a daemon set on all nodes of your cluster so they can monitor traffic and see how much you might be paying for all of the communication between different clusters. So that was definitely something that was interesting. I didn't expect them to have that capability because they were focused on Kubernetes cost optimization and monitoring. But having this capability should give customers like an end-to-end overview of how much money they're spending in these environments. The next thing was around open cost, right? How open cost is still available as a CNCF sandbox project, still available as an open source project. So customers who are not ready to pay that $100,000, right? I don't know how much KubeCost costs, but let's use $100,000 as a random number. Like not ready to pay that $100,000 worth of licenses for monitoring their cost on Kubernetes. They can get started using open cost, get a feel for how things are, how they can optimize their applications from day one, rather than going 18 months down the line and then trying to shift left and introduce cost management from day 365. So start using something like OpenCost or the KubeCost free tier as you're building those applications, as you're deploying things on Kubernetes. And then in the future, right, if you need that multi-cluster management that KubeCost paid tier offers, you can think about moving to that point. But having something that's free and open source definitely reduces the barrier to entry.
Absolutely. So as always, we will include all of the links mentioned in today's podcast, which is, you know, KubeCost, how to install it, OpenCost, some of the case studies, etc. And we
all
will
the different news articles we covered.
All the different news articles we covered. Also, you know, just good job on that, Bhavan.
Thank you. A lot
of news. Hard to cover it all. Yeah. And as always, please do review our podcast, whether that's on Apple Podcasts or wherever you review and listen to your podcasts. We encourage you to send us messages and or review us. It really helps us out. Or send us some options for what you'd like to hear. Today's episode was actually stemmed from one of our listeners. So thank you very much to talk more about cost and Kubernetes. So without further ado, that brings us to the end of today's episode. I'm Ryan.
I'm Bhavan.
And thanks for joining another episode of Kubernetes Bytes.
Thank you for listening to the Kubernetes Bytes podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.